The good people at Manscaped have partnered with us here at the Beautifully Designed Game podcast with an exclusive offer just for you as a thank you for tuning in. Visit uk.manscaped.com, enter promo code TFT20 for 20% off your order. Believe me, your balls will thank you.
Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome once again to the Beautifully Designed Game podcast. My name is Marcus Marrett and today I will be speaking to a fellow Glasgow-based illustrator, Kevin McGiven. Kevin, nice to meet you.
Hi Marcus, nice to meet you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I say meet you, we've actually played football against each other, so it should be nice to speak to you today, I guess.
Yeah, we have. I've scored a few goals past you, I'm sure.
Oh, you have. I think you did, yeah. Talking about football, that's a framed Celtic shirt behind you. Is that right?
It is, yeah. It's on the wall at the minute. The studio's getting done up, but it's about to go up on the wall, yeah. Henrik Larsson. In fact, you can't see underneath, but there's a signed Henrik Larsson programme underneath it as well.
Oh, very good.
There's actually a story behind it.
Oh, please go on. Good way to start.
Yeah. Well, me and a group of friends went to Helsingborg to see Henrik Larsson when he was playing there after he'd left Celtic in Barcelona. He went back to Sweden. So me and four friends went over and we were in the away end. We were playing Stockholm. So we went to Stockholm and standing in the crowd and four of us were wearing the Celtic green and white stripes. And at half-time, we get called down from the stand. And we thought we're going to get in trouble or we'd done something wrong. And they took us inside the stadium through all these back corridors. And they took us into this room that they'd converted into a Celtic room inside the National Stadium in Stockholm. Yeah. They had all sorts of memorabilia. They had big Celtic mirrors and pictures and photos and footballs and football boots and all this from all ex-players. And they said, do you want to meet Henrik after the game? And we were like, what? Yeah, so we met Henrik Larsson after the game and they signed our stuff and all that. So had to get that framed up and up in the wall when we came back home.
So that was by people working at the stadium that had seen you?
Yeah. Yeah, like the head groundsman, apparently, even from before Larsson or that connection, his dad had been a Celtic fan from the 60s and 70s. So he grew up as a Celtic fan. And it was just his hobby. There was a room not being used in the stadium. And he just kitted it out and all this Celtic stuff. It's bizarre, but it's totally true.
And that wasn't because my assumption was that that room was a Henrik Larsson connection, but it was an absolutely aside of that.
Yeah, it's just that this, and we're still in touch today. He came to my wedding, and it's started a whole new friendship. It's crazy, but and when you say why would the Swedish National Stadium have a Celtic dedicated room in it? It's like it's bizarre, but it's so we watched the whole game from the Celtic room, well, the whole second half.
Yeah,
and. Great day, great times.
I love to think of Johan Mjällby whenever I think of Sweden and Celtic.
Yeah, big Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Absolutely. Right, Kevin, can you introduce yourself? Tell us who you are and what is it you do?
I'm Kevin McGiven and I'm an illustrator based in Glasgow. Most of my work is sports-based. I do a lot of sports and football-based illustration. And I also do some work for other magazines, political magazines, historical magazines, book covers, movies. That's about it.
Okay, and you've got a fine art background, is that correct?
Well, my work is kind of fine art based, but I don't have any training. I haven't been to art school or studied art or anything. But
wow, really? So this is wholly self-taught?
Yeah, I only started about 6 years ago, about 6 years ago.
Really?
I hadn't drawn anything since school. Like, I left high school and my teachers had said, well, there's no career in art. You need to do something, get a real job type thing.
Wow, so I ended up studying that.
So I ended up studying engineering and was a structural engineer for 6 years. I then moved abroad. I moved to Greece and opened a bar there. Stayed there for 8 years. And all this time, I never picked up a pencil. I never drew a thing. And then when it came time to move home, I thought, what am I going to do? And I found a guy online who was doing digital painting online, doing live streams. And I thought, oh, that's quite interesting. I'll see if I can get into that. So kind of gave myself a year after coming home to try and make a go of it and make some money doing art, and just haven't stopped.
No, you absolutely haven't stopped. So there was just touch on this life adventure of opening a bar in Greece.
Yeah, I was basically fed up. I never really wanted to get into engineering in the first place. I was just kind of steered down that road because I had decent grades in maths and physics, and ended up doing that. Just had a choice of two courses and chose mechanical engineering. So then after 6 years, I applied for a career break, they call it, where you can take a year off and go abroad or do whatever and then come back. And my job said, no, you can't have the career break. So I arranged with my friend who was working in Greece at the time to get a job in his hotel. And I just quit my job and moved over there. Initially it was for the summer. And I was going to come back and do teaching or something like that afterwards. But I just enjoyed it too much over there and ended up staying over there. And the chance came up. There was a shop that was empty and on the main street of the town I was in, and saved a bit of money and thought I'll give it a go and open a bar.
What was it called?
And, Shamrock. It's an Irish bar.
Very good.
So it was good. Just like a live music bar. And I couldn't believe it, but there was no Irish bar there. And there was no one doing live music at the time. So I thought,
must be the only spot in the world that doesn't have an Irish bar.
I know, exactly. That's what I was thinking. So it was good. And stayed there for 8 years and it was great times. But
yeah,
it was a seasonal job. So you were working kind of 24 hours a day for 6 months. And then the winter months, everything closes up and you're just waiting for the summer again. So it wasn't really somewhere you could really settle down. It was good.
Okay.
Good place for a youngster, but not for kind of starting a family and stuff, whereas that was the stage I was at when we left.
Yeah. And so from picking up a pencil for the first time in years to producing work for Amazon Prime, BT Sports, all the high level work you do, where did that all start from, and was there a particular piece of work that you feel kind of broke you as such, or really was the start of something?
I can't think if there's a particular piece of work, but for the sports related work, I think it was the BT Sport competition that you were involved in as well, where it was
the hashtag Champions Draw, yeah, the
Champions
hashtag Draw, Champions
Draw
campaign, yeah.
I think I'd done a couple of portraits or something just off my own back and just posted them up online, and someone at BT Sport had found it on Twitter, I think. And they just reached out and said, "Did I want to be part of this Champions draw?" And that just kept feeding the sports work coming in, because you're doing 3 or 4 of them every year, and then other companies were seeing that, like Bleacher Report would then see that and say, "Could you do something similar for us?" And yeah, after that, I just kept feeding the sports work.
Okay, and I think that was when we first started chatting online, I think, during the hashtag Champions Draw. So just letting people know that, so it was a couple of seasons ago, for maybe 3 seasons in a row, there was a BT Sport campaign to promote their Champions League coverage. So there was a handful of illustrators, and we were given a match, and there was always very open. The briefs were open. There was essentially not a brief. You were given the dimensions and the template to work within, and you produce your piece for your given match. And then there was a voting competition, hence the Champions draw. And then whichever got voted through went to the next round in the Champions League format. Mm-hmm. I think every year was won by Dan Layden, was that right? He was like Zinedine Zidane's Real Madrid of the Champions draw era, yeah.
He is the social media champion, I think.
He is. He's a bit of a genius himself, yes. And so
his ideas are always great, though. They're always like really funny or really interesting ideas he came up with.
Yeah, there's a real sense of humour that comes through with Dan's work, absolutely. And so looking at your portfolio, there's a variance in art direction styles that you can apply. And to my eye, they're influenced by, I don't know if art movements from the past or particular eras. How do you decide or make the decision on what style you're going to do a piece of work?
It's not really a conscious thing. I've always thought I need to get a style. I need to find what my style is. Like you, for example, as soon as you see your work, you can tell it's you that's done it. And that's something that I've always really wanted in mind.
But that might just be people thinking everything I do looks the same.
But that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing.
Sorry, just jumping in here, we should actually tell people, can you just let people know where they can find you online, just so that they can be looking at things while we're talking about it?
My website is kevinmcgivern.com, and Instagram is... I always get confused. My Instagram and my Twitter are different. Kevin McGivern Art is Instagram, and Kev McGivern Art is Twitter.
There we go. Mm-hmm. And do you tend to use all of the social media channels to promote your work? Do you find one kind of works better for you, or do you put any particular focus on any of them?
I started out with about 10 places that I posted. Whenever I finished something, I would post it on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Behance, DeviantArt, Tumblr, all these different places. Now it's basically just the main 3, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
That a case of trying the options that were out there and seeing what really worked for you?
Yeah. What got the best reaction, what I just was more drawn to, really. Like Tumblr, I just never got. I was posting things up there and just leaving it and not like ever going back to it, and I thought, well, what's the point? Behance as well, I thought, I've seen other people on there and they've done really well, got loads of work from there, and again, just didn't seem to work for me. So I've just kind of stuck to what I know best.
Okay. Because you find you almost develop your own wee industry in a way that works for you. And if you give yourself time to let that develop, you can find what naturally works for you. Because I know Jack Daly, another Glasgow-based illustrator. I know Behance, for him, works brilliantly well. It's not a platform that has connected so much for me, but again, it's about how you use these platforms as well, kind of making them work hard for you.
Yeah, definitely. I've got Instagram just now is the one I'm kind of most into, and it's more from I do charcoal portraits. Mm-hmm. And I've been posting a lot of that work up there, and that seems to do well over on Instagram. So I think as well, it's the type of work that you're showing in certain places gets more of a reaction. A lot of the digital painting that I do, people assume it's just the computer that does the work. You'll get that as well, probably. it's done on a computer, so it's not hand-drawn, or it's not as creative in some way. But for me anyway, what I do in the digital painting is exactly the same. I just basically draw on the screen. But for some reason, the actual pencil on paper gets a much better reaction.
And from a technical point of view, when you're working digitally, what equipment and what software do you use?
I use Photoshop. That's the only software. Sometimes I draw on paper first and then scan it in. Sometimes I just draw straight in Photoshop. I've got a Wacom Cintiq tablet that just comes with a pen, and you just draw on the screen. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I just draw and paint straight in Photoshop. And I try and keep it as close to traditional art as I can. So I don't use many of the Photoshop kind of editing tools or layers. I try and keep it as
you can.
Yeah. I think it gives it that more kind of hand-drawn look as well, when you're, instead of undoing mistakes, you're kind of drawing over them or whatever. And it makes me feel like I'm more in control rather than the computer.
Okay, yeah. You know what I mean? And I've noticed you've often shared process videos as such, or giving people insights to you working with dry and wet material, mm-hmm. outside of a digital screen. Is that something that you feel it's important to show people about what you're doing, that, you know, this is me working with traditional medium, and you're happy to share people that working away from the screen?
Yeah, I think it just helps people see that basically how slow the process is a lot of the time, and how what goes into it. Instead of just seeing the final image on a screen, you see the kind of blood, sweat and tears that goes into it a lot of the time. You don't show all the times that you scrunch it up and throw it in the bin, but you do. It's good for people to see kind of behind the scenes and show a bit of the process. And other artists actually like it as well, because I'm the same. I like to see the process of other artists and try and get a few tricks from them and see how they work as well.
Okay. And you've got a whole gallery of your charcoals online. So on kevinmcgivin.com, people can find this. Incredibly detailed charcoal drawings, even more so given you're not someone that was formally educated and self-taught. How long does a typical charcoal portrait like this take, or is it absolutely open until you feel satisfied that it's complete?
Yeah, at the moment I do most of the charcoal stuff is just for my own kind of enjoyment. I've had a couple of jobs that came in for charcoal work, but in the main it's just me doing it because I enjoy it, and so there's not really a time limit on them. When they're finished, they're finished. But in general, they take, for a standard portrait, takes about between 5 and 8 hours, I would say.
Okay.
Just depending on the details and what's involved. But I like charcoal because it is a bit more messy and a bit quicker than it's funny, the digital work is it's a bit easier because you can undo mistakes, or you can, it's not permanent in any way, so you can just, you can do it, you can make changes forever, but that also is a kind of time suck because you can zoom in forever and get every detail exactly how you want it, whereas something like charcoal is inherently messy and you just do your best to refine it as much as you can.
And are you, you may well have a far more advanced method than this, but I do remember my days at art school using hairspray to set charcoal so it doesn't smudge. Is that still happening these days, or is there something more refined than that?
Well, it's still a spray. It's a fixative spray, they call it, for charcoal and pastels. And a lot of people actually don't like using them because they change the value of the kind of darks and lights. They kind of dull everything down. So if you can, you just put it straight in a frame behind glass and leave it. Don't touch it. But if you've got to send it out, sometimes I sell the portraits and they've got to be mailed out, and you've just got to spray them because they would just get destroyed otherwise. But the spray I've got seems to work fine for me. I don't mind it.
Okay. And do you find a lot of value in having that work that is wholly yours? It's visually, it's a lot different than the client work you do, or at least that I've seen. And so is it important for you to have that creative outlet that is wholly yours and gives you that break from your client commissions?
Yeah, it's just something that I've always just felt drawn to since I started doing art. Again, when I was at school, it was always pencil and paper that I enjoyed the most. And since doing it again, I was doing it as a job. I'd only really been doing it digitally, and I thought, why not just get the pencil and paper out and do it for fun and see, like, don't expect anything of it. And I wouldn't say it's important for me. I don't feel like the digital is a grind I've got to get through to do the charcoal stuff, but it's just something that I enjoy, and if I've got time, I'll do it. And hopefully the more I do, the more of that kind of work I'll be able to get in. I've sold a few of the portraits, and as I say, on Instagram, it's getting more and more popular, so we'll see what comes of it, but I'm not expecting anything.
Okay. Now, talking of your portraiture work, can you talk us through what are the key considerations that you take into account when planning a portrait? Obviously, there's the need for the visual likeness, but in terms of also pulling through a person's character, what is it that you look for? What is it that you find is important to pull out to create a strong looking portrait?
Well, for the sports related stuff, there's always a lot of the time it's kind of sports players in action, or you don't have a lot of leeway with putting your own personality into it, but with that, the portrait and the kind of expressions on the face and things like that, one of my art heroes was Norman Rockwell. And he was just a master of finding like a cross between realism and caricature. So he was like, he would make a nose a tiny bit bigger, or he would make the eyebrows kind of slightly higher, or the chin a bit longer, and it just adds to the expression but keeps it in the realism. It makes the person look even more like the person than just a standard photo, if you know what I mean. And that's what I try and aim for. I mean, I'm not Norman Rockwell, but I try and make the person look more like the person than a photo does, if you know what
yeah,
I mean.
So almost pulling out. So the kind of known recognition features of a person, almost exaggerating them to a wee touch, not necessarily to make it caricature like, but almost 5% exaggerating a visual trait of someone that can really push that portrait through.
For example, I did one for Amazon recently. It was Jurgen Klopp, and he was dressed as a kind of royal king. And
I was going to ask you about this specific piece. Yes, yeah, go on.
And that was one that I tried to do that with. Where obviously he's got his white teeth and his big smile, so you just kind of accentuate that, and he's make his eyes a bit even more like happy looking, and the pose that he stands in, just make it a bit more, like you say, 5% more exaggerated, make his teeth a tiny bit whiter than they are in the photo, or and even just like the skin colouring and all that. I don't want people say, oh, it's so good, it looks like a photo, and that's not what I'm going for. I want it to look kind of hand drawn and just a slight bit more exaggerated than a photo would be.
With the style of the work that you do, do you feel a responsibility at all to, as a practicing artist now, to keep the traditional ways of working in the past kind of somewhat relevant, you know, that by referencing the art movements and the art styles from the past, and obviously the work outside of your digital screen that you do, that there is a responsibility to keep on applying the art history as such to kind of modern days of working, because as much as you may be humble and not think so, there will be many people around the world that see the work that you do that both find it aspirational, that I would love to be able to do that myself, but also by doing work in the styles that you do, you're paying homage to art movements from hundreds of years ago, and there's real value in that.
Yeah, it's not something I'm conscious of. I think it's just that's all I've known, really. Like, because I have just taught myself from drawing pencil and paper, I was never really open to, like for yourself, the vector side of art, or the the kind of computer graphics, or the even the more digital side of art. That's only something that I've learned as I've went along. So I think I'm more drawn to that because it's what I know. That's what I would find easier to pick up, is because that's all I know. Like my other art hero is Drew Struzan. He's like a movie poster artist, and he's done all the Star Wars posters and the Harry Potter posters, and thousands of posters. And again, it's just a hand drawn look, and he's one of the first guys that I looked at and thought, oh, you can actually make a living doing artwork. And I think it's just from seeing these guys that I've been kind of took down that path. But when I look at other people, especially in the sports world, doing artwork for the sports world, it isn't the art realist that I'm drawn to. I like the kind of graphic side and the like yourself and Stan Chow and Daniel Nyari that do kind of vector based artwork. That appeals to me, because I could never do it, I think. Just that's what I appreciate in other people's work.
Okay. And just good to absorb other styles as well, so you're not so much in your own kind of wee bubble, probably a bad term to use at the moment, in your bubble with what's going on, but you get the point. Yeah. So why football? What is it that has drawn you to working in the football world so much? What's your connection to the sport?
I've just always been obsessed with football since as long as I can remember. Played football and grown up.
Born and raised in Glasgow, is that right?
Yep. Played for Celtic youth when I was young.
Oh, really? Up to what age?
About 15, I think. Or 14, maybe.
Which position?
Yeah, I played right wing at the time. It was 4-3-3 we played, and I was always wide right.
At the front three, and then as I go three.
The front three. No defending. No defending.
Okay. You're one of those.
Yeah. I can run as fast as you want forward, but don't ask me to run backwards.
Fair enough.
And then as I got older, I just moved more into midfield. And I kept playing as I got older. And I just loved it. I had a season ticket at Celtic Park for about 10 years until I moved abroad. And I just love it. I watch any two teams playing football.
Yeah. Who are your football heroes growing up?
Well, the main one is Paul McStay for Celtic. He was my absolute idol. And after that, it's probably Ronaldo.
For any of the audience that aren't aware of Paul McStay, can you give us a short bio on the man? Sell him to us.
His nickname's a maestro. He played centre midfield, and he could do everything. He was like box to box. He was scored goals. He was a great engine. He was a captain. He was like the all round midfielder. He was like Steven Gerrard before Steven Gerrard.
Okay. Did he defend?
Yep, he did defend.
And so in talking about the football world, what would be a dream brief for you? Something that hasn't happened, but you would love to do? Putting you on the spot, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
In the football world?
Digging deep into your mind here.
I know, a dream brief for football related. I have been quite lucky. Like, I've worked with a lot of the big companies. Maybe something like working with a specific club and doing. I was actually
would that be Celtic for you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I was approached a couple of years ago. Celtic Park were changing the kind of facade around the outside, and they wanted. They were putting up big. I don't know what the material is, but they were putting up big kind of signs all the way around the stadium.
Okay.
And they wanted artwork of legendary players all the way around.
Yeah.
And they asked me, would I be interested? Nothing ever came of it. They ended up just going with old photographs of the players instead of artwork. But that would have been pretty cool to have seen my work on the outside of the stadium.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's the big tall, because we've played back at Glasgow Green once so far this season, and it's the big tall kind of black and white photos.
Yeah.
Kind of draped around Parkhead. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, I know this is probably not something you want to hear, but around Ibrox, Rangers have done a lot of really nice improvements visually and branding wise and signage wise, and Craig Black, who we both know based here in Glasgow, who's created a Glasgow Rangers typeface fresh for this season.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah,
it's made a big difference to how Ibrox is looking this season.
Yeah, I saw Craig's really work. Well. Really cool. Looks really cool. He's another guy that's. Even though his work has nothing to do with mine, I just love the things that he produces. His creativity Absolutely. Is so good, yeah. Even if it is for Rangers.
I know, yeah. He's a big blue as well, so it kept him happy.
Yeah, My other dream job, I think, just thinking about it while we're talking there, would probably be the cover of 442 magazine.
Oh, yes.
I've got to illustrate that. Just because I've bought that magazine since I was young, and that would be cool to see my work on that cover.
Well, they do really nice subscriber covers. I've noticed a couple of beautiful examples. Should Houndanth more?
Yeah,
I'll give you the contact for that. Well, you've probably got it already, but hey, if anyone's gonna scream and shout for you to do a piece of work, it's gonna be you.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I'm not the best at that. I'm not the best marketer in that way, but yeah. And if you're listening, I'll definitely do your cover for you.
So in terms of marketing your work, it's interesting you say that, because you must be doing something right to get the briefs into you that you do. But is it something that you're always conscious of and thinking, oh, I could be doing something better or doing something different to get your work seen by the right people?
Yeah, it's the problem is, probably like most artists, I enjoy the drawing and painting more than the emails and business side. I don't mind marketing as such, but it's the email side where you've got to kind of send updates and ask art directors if they've got work going, or just to keep in mind. I know it's good practice to like send out emails and keep in mind of art directors, but just because I find it so boring to do it, I just never get around to doing it. And I suppose I'm lucky that just they find me more often than not, that I've managed to keep getting work.
Well, maybe that's the way that the industry of Kevin McGivern works, you know, that if you're finding people are finding you, as much as let's not rest on your laurels in that, I mean, your work is that visually engaging, everybody's going to, you know, it's gonna draw the attention of so many. Maybe it's just you've got that magical gift of not having to do so much pushing out, and it all comes into you. Good for you.
I suppose that the posting on social media and the interactions on there is just a form of marketing, isn't it? When you're
absolutely
commenting on people's things and you're replying and all that, and posting up your own work and responding to comments and all that is, I suppose, marketing. But the actual sending out postcards and emailing art directors, that kind of thing, I should do more of it, but I just never get around to it.
And in terms of working and planning work for different formats, so you've produced covers for Imagine FX, and you also do work for use on social channels for BT Sports, for example, and you produce work for Amazon Prime. How do you approach, or what would the difference be when considering how to approach a composition for a magazine cover or a smaller space when it comes to social? How do you plan your work for dealing with these different size formats?
Yeah, the first consideration you've got to have is, where's the artwork going to be used? And if it's a magazine cover, then you can get quite detailed, and you can it's got to be kind of striking so that you can see it on a shelf across the shop in a on a magazine stand. But also, because it's printed at a decent size, you can get quite nitty gritty with the details. If it's a small editorial piece, then there's not really much point, because the printing takes all the details out of it. So it's got to be kind of more of a bold compositional shape that you incorporate in. And again, in social media, when you do the work for us, particularly the sports companies, they tend to like bold colours and engaging shapes and compositions that just attract the eye. They want eyes on their social media channels, so it's got to be something appealing for likes and shares, basically.
Okay. And in terms of what's happening next for you, give us an idea of what's coming up from Kevin McGivern. What's in the pipeline? As much as you can tell us right now. I'm sure you've got many briefs that you can't tell us about at the moment, but what's coming up?
Well, I wish I knew with this coronavirus. No one knows, do they?
That's true,
no
yeah.
No one knows
yeah.
what's happening. But no, basically just more of the same. I've got kind of regular clients now that keep coming back, and I'm quite lucky in that even through all this uncertain time, I've still had work coming in, and I've just been able to basically carry on. Not a lot's changed, but I work from home and I just do the same as I've always done. And like I say, the work has kept coming in, and it's a nice feeling to have the kind of regular clients and just be able to do, even though every brief is different, to get comfortable with the publications you're working with or the companies you're working with, it's quite a nice feeling to have. And going forward, I think I would just like to do more of the charcoal work. Again, that seems to be going down quite well on Instagram and stuff. So I'll keep doing that and just see where that leads me as well.
Fantastic. Very good. And given that a lot of the time during this chat, my eyes have been drawn to the Celtic shirt framed behind you, just talking about kit. So it's a question I've been enjoying asking everybody on the show. Give us your choice of favourite kit of now, of these days, or of your childhood, or of any kit you've ever seen.
Where do I start?
Where do you start? Good point.
I think, well, I'll get my favourite Celtic one out of the way first.
Go on then.
It's the 1985 Celtic home kit. And it actually the current kit is quite closely based off it. It's really retro. It's like typical 80s kind of, it's hard to describe. It's quite plain, green and white hoops, green and white trim around the collar and neck, and it's just a classic.
Sorry, has that Celtic kit got any special connotations because of certain players or the time of your life, or is it just visually a really good looking kit?
It's a bit of both. When I look back now, it's like really retro, and I like that kind of retro style.
Yeah.
But it's the first strip I remember Paul McStay wearing. So that's I've kind of been drawn to that. But yeah, the other, if I could only keep one kit, it would have to be a Brazil kit. Brazil World Cup kits are just always the best, I find.
Okay.
That yellow, green, and blue, the combination is just like classic. So I would say the Brazil 1978 kit is probably my all-time favourite. It's obviously the yellow kit, but it's got the three Adidas stripes down the sleeves.
Yes.
And obviously the blue shorts, white socks is just classic.
I love to see an unbroken three stripes down a sleeve.
Yeah.
It's whenever I see Adidas kits these days, I think, oh, if only the world didn't have sleeve sponsors and league matches, which I'm assuming is why you don't ever see it anymore. But it's such a shame.
True. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's so retro, but just simple but classic.
Yeah. What about in terms of boots? When you were flying down the wing for Celtic under 15s, what boots did you wear? Do you remember?
Yeah, I wore a lot of boots. None of them are the boots I wanted.
Go on then. What were the boots you did want?
I always wanted Adidas Copa Mundials. Always.
Nice. Yeah.
Just, again, the classic. the mold, not screw-ins, the mold is the white sole with the black studs.
Yes.
That's, I always wanted them, but they were always too expensive. So I would get kind of as close as I could find to them. I remember I had a pair of Patrick?
Yes, yes.
I had a pair of them, and the only reason I got them was because I had the white soles and the black studs.
Nice, yeah.
Just because they, I wanted...
They always looked so good hung up on the wall, didn't they, yeah, with the soles facing outwards? Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's only referees that wear them, but it's they've always been my favourite boots. And then the other pair that I always wanted but never got was the original Predator, the 1994 yes, Predator boots. Just because they were so bizarre when they first came out.
That, yeah.
These kind of teeth on the top of the boots was just bizarre looking, but...
And do you remember the three stripes on the side? I remember the three of them, they were wider at one end, and then the three of them kind of tapered in and mm-hmm, were curved at the end, which that was different in itself. Yeah. You're actually the second person on this podcast that's given that exact answer, that exact
thing. Really, yeah,
as well. Yeah, yeah.
They are... Yeah, they're classic. I mean, every Predator, there's nicer boots than those two, like, that have come out, a lot more stylish and a lot more cool, but they're just classic. I just love retro and classic things.
Well, the reason for me asking these questions to the people that we're speaking to is to find out that the emotive choices versus the choice is based on purely visually aesthetic, you know, because everyone has choices based on, oh, I love that kit because that player or that match or that competition or this period of my life, or oh, I love that kit because it's just a really nice looking kit. Yeah. You know,
it's hard to disassociate the player from the kit. So
yeah.
When you try and think of your favourite kit, there's always a player wearing it. And well, in my mind, there is, like, another kit I loved was the West Germany 1990, that kit. And it's just Lothar Matthäus is wearing that kit. And it's Roberto Baggio wearing the Juventus kit. It was just classic to me. It's all my favourite players. I think of my favourite players and what kits they wear, and they tend to be my favourite kits.
Ah, got you. So it's really based for you. It's about the player that wore the kit rather than the kit itself. Okay.
Yeah, and the kind of time period, like the when the Italian football was on Channel 4.
Yes.
I was obsessed with that programme and all those Italian teams around that time. Barese playing for AC Milan with the... Yeah. Big flappy collar and stuff. It's just so cool.
Do you remember the mad Milan kit of the 90s when the kits were made by Lotto? Do you remember this mad blue one with like a crazy pattern on the front and kind of red trim? It was almost like a bluey grey. I remember George Ware wearing it. It might even have been a third kit if they did third kits back in the day. You know, I'm trying to subtly do a wee bit of a Google search right now.
Yeah, me too.
Milan blue kit. This would be good reading. Well, sorry, good listening for podcast.
Oh yeah, I think I see it. Opel sponsor.
Ah yes, there we are. What year was that? Here we go, just so people can go away and look at it themselves. And 95, 96.
Yeah.
Yes, there we go.
I don't even remember seeing that before.
That's less grey than I remember it being, more real sky blue. No, I only ever remember it. I remember seeing the team lined up before a match, but I don't ever remember it being worn in a match. But I guess back in the day, it could have just been a one-off for a European tie, maybe. Right, well, can you remind everyone where they can find you online, Kevin, and where they can follow your work?
Yep, just go to kevinmcgivern.com and you'll see all my work there, and all my social channels go out from there.
Fantastic. And there's a newsletter that people can sign up to on your site. Is that right?
Yeah, you just put in your email address and I'll send out every so often. It's not very often, but just any new work that I have, I'll just send them out and if you're interested.
Fantastic. Well, I recommend everybody highly do that. And I will say, Kevin, I'm going to hassle you once again to get back on the football field and face me between the sticks once again. So now that football's returned to Glasgow, slowly but safely, let's face each other on that pitch once again.
Yeah. Yeah, I look forward to it.
Good man. Brilliant. All right, Kevin, thank you very much for your time today. And go and find Kevin online and enjoy everything that he does. Thank you very much.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.